started, I wanted to just thank people. I'm Will Engel. I'm here at the University of British Columbia, and I'm a strategist for open education initiatives. And I've been working with Brian Lamb a little bit on this. We piloted, as I like to call it, earlier this summer, and then this is really just our second open ed chat. And the ideas behind these are to just have a very informal, loose and casual talking about what's going on in open education in the province and looking at some specific projects, doing some case studies, and just sort of chatting on a regular basis. And I really want to thank Frank Fusil of BC Campus and BC Campus in general and the ETUG community, the Educational Technology Users Group, for their support in this as well. Brian, did you have anything you wanted to say?
Yeah, no, not really, other than to part of the, hopefully the motivation for these open chats too is some audio that we'll be using in case studies and other media later too. So just do keep in mind what we're recording to get reused in some other context.
No pressure.
Great. So I think we're going to start off with just a sort of overview of a project or a couple projects here at UBC, and then just move in forward into an open chat. And I would say in the sort of informal nature of these and open natures that we're going to keep all the mics open. And if you have questions, to go ahead and jump in and ask questions of the if you're not, you can self-mute your own mic if you have noise in the background or whatnot. But otherwise, let's just chat. So I'm excited today to sort of kick off the project with a couple faculty members here at UBC who have been working on a pretty neat project called the Arts One Open Project. So Arts One is a year-long interdisciplinary program taught at UBC, and it combines history, English, and philosophy to introduce students to some of the classic texts of world civilizations. It's really a great books course. And I want to say about a year ago, was it only a year? They decided to create an open online extension or complement to that. And what they at the time called Arts One Digital, which has now been repurposed just in the last few weeks to Arts One Open. And the goal of this was to enable anyone to join the voyage of discovery and critical analysis of the great texts that they're teaching. So today we have Christina Hendricks, who's a senior instructor who teaches in both philosophy and in Arts One. Christina has a lot of background in open education. She took a connectivist MOOC called eTech MOOC and is also running another project called the Open Online Experience 2013. Is that the correct name?
Yeah. I'm not running it. I'm one of a large group of people who are helping to put it together.
Great. Sorry. Then we also have John Buzu-Murray, who is widely known, I think, in the open ed tech world here in BC, and John was one of the big drivers behind the Arts One Digital project, and he's been involved in lots of open education programs, including using such tools as open blogs, having students write directly to Wikipedia and create Wikipedia articles, using Twitter and YouTube in his courses. And I'm just going to maybe turn it over to you guys and let you just sort of give an overview of Arts One, and I'll jump in with some questions if that.
Well, why don't I say a little bit about Arts One, and then John, you can talk about the Arts One Open Project, because you're the one who started it while I was out of town. So yeah, Will has already said a little bit about the program. It's a year long. There are students get 18 credits for participating in this program, so it really counts for quite a bit of their first year. It's a writing intensive program. We do about a book a week in terms of reading. And then students write a paper approximately every 2 weeks on that book or that set of texts. Sometimes it's more than one text. A good portion of the time in Arts One is spent in discussion with students, where we just sit around in small groups, up to 20, no more than 20, and discuss the books, the essays, and they come up with their own ideas. We try to get them to speak and offer what they think as much as possible in that time, and then they write their essays, which are on topics that we suggest, but they also take those in their own directions. And then we meet with them in groups of four to do peer review of their essays as well. So a good portion of time is spent in a very small group with students and their professors. Though we do have a once a week 2-hour lecture on each text, which is where one of us gives our views on the book, and then the rest of the time is students and professors talking together. So I guess that's just a little bit of of overview of how the program works, which might help to understand what we're doing in our open extension of it. So John, do you want to say some things?
So I just had a couple more things about Arts One. In some ways, it is a great books course, but in some ways, it's more diverse than that, because there's a sort of there's some people, there's some core people who teach it year on year, but other faculty rotate in and out, and there's a whole series of different themes that change every couple of years. And so it ranges from Genesis, from the Greeks, Plato, Sophocles, through to Shakespeare, but also kind of more marginal writers or less familiar writers or post-colonial writers. Or there's a lot in Arts One, and there's a certain amount of flux as well as a certain amount of continuity in the program. So I guess, yeah, it was about a year ago when we were at UBC told from above about this Coursera initiative, and I saw the email and noticed that all the courses, the first courses that were being proposed that were going to be taught by Coursera were all science courses. And I thought, well, why is that? Why shouldn't the arts be involved in such initiatives? And why should we have to do it via Coursera? Why can't we figure out our other ways of trying to open up and use this kind of material? So from then on, yeah, we're sort of putting things together on no budget, essentially, less than a shoestring budget. Working with Arts IT at UBC to record lectures, doing podcasts, because a colleague had a sort of fancy microphone and would stick it in the office and chat about a couple of books, and using blogs and plenty of ways to sort of syndicate the blogs, and setting up the website, which both Brian and I have linked to there as a kind of, I don't know, a hub to bring together the various things that we've tried to do. We've worked on things like badging and Twitter streams, and just really interested in as much as time permits, and time doesn't always permit very much, to think about ways in which we can open up the course. On the one hand, for our own students, for the UBC students, like all this is meant to benefit the students who are taking the course. There are a little less than a couple of 100 overall who takes Arts One, divided into two groups, but ways in which to enrich the experience for them, but also in such a way that, yeah, the principle has been it's always open, hence the recent name change from Arts One Digital to Arts One Open, I guess, to underline that, do whatever Open does, right? Break down some of the barriers between the university and the outside, the public, the common, to create resources that we stick on YouTube and CC by NC, and we stick them up on archive.org as well, create stuff that anyone can use in any way that they feel appropriate, fit, or of interest.
Maybe I could just say something about the lectures, because we do record, well, in one of the two groups. There are two groups every year that have different themes and different professors. But in one of those two groups, we have all of the lectures, the two-hour lectures every Monday, being recorded and posted on YouTube and, as John said, on archive.org. But they're two-hour lectures, which could, you know, you might think, well, that's a lot of stuff to use. How am I going to reuse that? It's too much to watch through. But we also have a kind of bookmarking system. I don't really know what it's called exactly, but a way to annotate the lectures so that you can quickly move to certain parts of them, which I think will help. And that's useful for on-campus students as well, not just people looking at it from the outside, because these lectures are sometimes very complicated and they move quickly and they are quite long, and students don't always pay as much attention as they should throughout all the parts, and they can always go back and watch part of it that they were confused about. So that was just one thing I wanted to say about the lectures. And we're also inviting students to blog in one of the two groups. So my students all have created their own blogs on the UBC blog system, which is a WordPress install. And I'm asking them to blog every couple of weeks on the books. And we use those sometimes as springboards for discussion in class. They are also aggregated into the main Arts One Open blog site, or main Arts One Open site, so that all students who are blogging, all of their posts get aggregated into one place, and then all the students can read the blog posts of other students, even if they're not in their own main course, which they do. And some have told me that that's been really useful for them to see other people's views on the text.
Thanks for bringing up the student blogs, because I actually think that's one of a very interesting parts of Arts One Open, and in some ways, like, blogs and wikis are seen and not as a very innovative tool, but there's this movement around student as producer and elevating student role in learning to not being a passive part of learning, but to being sort of on equal footing with the instructor, to be a active collaborator with the instructors. And I really see the way you've set up the blogging part to be part of that. And one of the things I love, if anybody goes to the Arts One Open site and you see sort of a tag cloud down there, you can click on something like Shakespeare, and it'll come up with not just the lectures, but also blog posts that are students' blogs. And I wonder if you could just talk about your motivation and that sort of the strategy employed for implementing that a little bit.
Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I've been using blogs, I guess, in courses for a long time, as Brian and Will and others may know. One of the things that's interesting here is that the way in which the course is set up, the students are divided. They all come together for the big lecture at the beginning of the week, but then they're divided into different seminar groups. I was teaching on Arts One also last year, and so I got my students blogging, and then one of my colleagues, who's now the head chair of Arts One, Rob Crawford, said, "Oh, that's interesting. Kind of, how do you do that?" And there's a little sort of minor blogging on his part and a couple of his students' part last year. And it's really kind of taken off this year, with I think three of the seminar groups are doing that, and I find it fascinating. Just sort of, I said they all sort of come together as they're aggregated in the main site. Each group's the instructor policies and procedures and way they're doing it are slightly different. I think it doesn't really matter or make much difference to the outside observer. But sort of seeing them dialogue with each other, seeing the kinds of points that they bring up. I mean, I find I'm doing the lectures at the moment, last week and next week, and I'm really finding it helpful and interesting to see what the students are saying, and I can see what they're saying in any of the groups in which they have blogs. It gives me a sort of feedback on the kind of interests that they have, the kinds of things that they've picked up on, and, you know, to some extent, the things that may need some, I don't know, stress or correction on my part as well. I find it really useful and really helpful, and to see it happen in this kind of broader, more sort of networked context rather than just my own group, my own class, is really interesting. So I'm not sure exactly what the thought was. That it was just sort of try something, and other people thinking, yeah, that's kind of cool, we'll try it too. And to me, it's really working out. I don't know what how you're seeing things, Christina.
I think it's great. So one of the things that I've experienced in the past in Arts One is that students go to the lecture, they read the book, they go to the lecture, they come to seminar, and they don't really necessarily have anything prepared to think about or say, even if I suggest that they should. And sometimes I'll, you know, go around and ask what people think, and I get a bunch of blank stares. But if I ask them to blog about it first before we meet in seminar, then they at least have thought about something, right? They've dug into some aspect of the text or the lecture, and have something they can contribute. And what I'd like to see more, they're not doing very much of yet, is more of each other commenting on their blogs and having more of a conversation outside of class. That's what I was really hoping for this to support as well. But that hasn't happened yet. I think I just need to sort of give a bit of a push that I comment on their blogs, but I tend to be the only one doing it. So I think it could be useful for that if we get that going.
Christina, when I use blogs, I tell them the part of the exercises they have to comment on two of each other's blogs each week.
I don't want to get into counting comments. That's just such a pain. Like, the things I have to keep track of. It's just hard to keep track of all these things, you know, like, okay, I'm going to have to count all the comments now, and does everyone have two comments? And I understand. Yeah,
I don't really. I just, at the end of the semester, I have a look through and get a general sense of who's been commenting on that. But they think we're watching with our eagle eyes, you know?
Yes, I'd also say something like that.
I'd say a couple more things. So first of all, Christina mentioned the kind of, I don't know, the bookmarking facility. This is something that I think Novak and his team developed. Although I have to say that, so all the lectures from last year, when we did a sort of pilot of the thing, of the Arts One, what we're now calling Arts One Open, they all have this bookmarking. But it's pretty time intensive, so I actually haven't done it this year. We've put in for some money and one of the purposes of that is to get to someone who can kind of is paid to have some time to run the thing. The same is true of the tags that Will mentioned. So some of the students are already tagging their posts, and that comes through and feeds into the main site. But also periodically I have to go through and tag those and clean up the tags and get rid of the uncategorized tags and so on. And that's a little bit time consuming too. So, I mean, our principle has been to try and do this with, I don't know, the minimum effort possible to sort of avoid self-exploitation, but it would be good if we had more resources, if we had some resources, essentially. So that's what we're looking to for the future.
Yeah, we definitely, John has been putting in a whole bunch of work just on his own time, and we can't continue to rely on that. So that is really the issue with us, is that we've built this really, I think, robust and interesting extension of the course online and open to anyone who wants to join in. But right now we don't have the resources to continue it. So we've started it, and unless we decide to just not have a life, we can't continue to do it for very many more years without funding. So that's the problem. There was a question by Cindy.
Yeah, I'm just responding to that by text, I guess.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so Cindy's question is about whether people are participating for interest rather than credit. And I don't, John will probably answer that. As yet, we don't have any formal participants from outside. But we are inviting people to do that slowly. We haven't really done any publicity around that because we still have to work out who is going to be in charge of making sure all the blogs are aggregated, who is going to be in charge of administering the badges if people do apply for badges. We, you know, we've kind of moved ahead with the technology to put it in place and have it be ready for when we actually figure out the back end of how this is all going to work in terms of personnel, and are we going to be able to hire somebody to do that. So it is available for anyone to join in, but we haven't done a big push to make it public and let people know about that.
No, I think that's something that I want us to move to. I mean, carefully, because we don't want to be swamped. Again, we don't have the support, essentially. But little by little, I mean, there's a whole load of expressions of interest. I say on the YouTube, some of our videos have got quite a lot of hits, up to about 4,000. We have something like 88 subscribers to the Arts One Open channel on YouTube as well. We get, you know, people coming into the website. Obviously, you know, some of these people are just dipping in, right, rather than taking, you know, watching a whole lecture, for instance. As Christina mentioned, these are in general 2-hour lectures, though I personally am interested in video podcasts and sort of breaking down the lectures in different ways and making them more sort of modular and useful, although we don't want to, you know, impose such changes, I guess, on our colleagues and move too rapidly on that. But there's certainly interest out there, and I think that there's the potential for a lot more if we were to, you know, give it a sort of publicity push.
And then sort of, you kind of have hit on this, but I think something that we talk about in open ed or we don't talk about enough is when we talk about like sort of creating open educational resources and we talk about the sharing in terms often of a legal framework around Creative Commons and making sure things are licensed properly so they can be reused. But what I think is interesting about Arts One Open and potential of Arts One Open is the idea that you're really creating new resources. So you have a large course that's a two-semester course, a two-term course, but you're actually developing new pathways. And some of that is just in the, for example, in the YouTube videos, you're creating the bookmarks or chapters so you can provide direct access to specific parts of a lecture rather than having someone to watch that whole lecture. So someone wants to really use a specific area of your lecture, they can point directly to that. There's some talk about implementing open badges, so someone could come in and just do maybe a badge on Shakespeare rather than having to take a whole two-term course. Do you guys have thoughts on that, or is that accurate, or is that somewhere you would like to go?
Absolutely. We don't. I mean, because the Arts One that students take on campus, as Christina said right at the beginning, it's a really quite an intensive course. It's 18 credits, so that means, and it's a year-long course. So that means, I guess, it's the equivalent of, you know, 6 regular courses. And we don't intend to, I guess, compromise on that in any way. So the question is to offer the material in some more modular ways for people from outside, if they wish, to establish their own pathways. And we can suggest certain ones too, as Will's saying, that we've sort of outlined possible kind of badge systems, which suggest different approaches to the text. The other thing is too, because the syllabus is constantly changing. Every couple of years, there's a new theme, although certain texts get repeated. Over time, I think we're establishing this archive, essentially, of material of different kinds, lectures, podcasts, blog posts, and so on, which is really a rich resource in the three sort of general areas that Arts One covers: history, philosophy, and literature. And so it won't take long before, you know, a couple of years before it is this, this enormous, it becomes more and more this enormous resource. And I'm interested also, incidentally, in ways in which to sort of connect it with other kinds of resources that might be out there, might be produced elsewhere. But that's more ambitious still.
And there's another aspect that I particularly like too, and I jokingly called this on Twitter Novak's Law, because I've heard him say it a number of times, but the best way for a university to promote itself is to expose the work of its people. And in a lot of ways, I see that's what Arts One's doing. And its people is not just its faculty and its researchers, but also its students. So you're creating this really rich resource, and as you say, as it goes on through time, it'll become richer and more in depth. But it's also really exposing what the Arts One program is, and I'm hoping that you'll see maybe more uptake of Arts One, because people can actually come in and see what Arts One is actually about rather than just reading descriptions of it.
Yeah, John just said, yep, that's a big part of the idea. Yeah, so, this program has been around for, many years, since 1967. But for some strange reason, it just isn't all that well known, even amongst high schools in BC. We continually get students who say, oh, I just barely heard about Arts One right at the last minute, whereas I was about to register for something else. So we really think that we think it's a great program for many reasons. And we think that if more people knew about it, we might actually get more uptake, especially if they can kind of already participate, right? They can see what students are talking about in seminars by looking at their blogs. If they can see the lectures, they can actually even participate in watching the lectures live, which is something we're trying to do this term, and then participate on Twitter as we talk about the lectures on Twitter. That will give them more of a sense of what actually goes on. Now, one other thing that I had forgotten to mention earlier is that one of the projects we hope to do in the future, if we get the funding to continue this in more depth, is to create a student journal and post that on our open site, but make it really a kind of online journal, where in the past, what we've done is we've asked students to submit essays for an essay prize, but then nothing really happens to those essays. They don't really go anywhere. Nobody sees them. So this way, they could submit it specifically for publication in a journal, and that would also showcase the work that students do in their essays, right? So students, so other people can see what it's like to write an art-to-one essay, and especially good art-to-one essay.
So I had an interesting conversation earlier this week with somebody who was sort of aghast at the idea of students being out there and doing work in what I would call the open internet. And outside of Arts One Open, but within Arts One Open, you guys have a lot of experience in this area too, the idea of students interacting with what could be a hostile presence of other people out there on the internet. And John, I know you had your students work with Wikipedia, which can often be a hostile experience for new people coming into that space. And Christina, I know you've done work around connectedness MOOCs and those sort of experiences. What has been the student experience about having their blogs out there sort of in the open world? And have you had any pushback or any thoughts about that?
I have not had any pushback. Some students were a little worried about, you know, just figuring out how to do it. I think some students may be a little reticent to speak everything that they think. I can kind of tell on the blogs who's more open and ready to just sort of talk and who is really holding back, and that's okay, that's fine. But nobody has said, boy, I really don't want my stuff out there. Now, I did give them the option of making their blog available only to other students, so that it's not public, because that's quite easy to do on UBC blogs. But nobody took up that option. I also gave them the option to create a pseudonym, but that doesn't really work for the class. Everyone knows who they are because I only have 16 students. So, but if they could create a pseudonym for the outside world if they chose, and they didn't do that either. One interesting thing that has happened is one of my students came up to me one day and said, you know, I wrote this thing that was about something that was happening on campus outside of the class. And I put it on my blog, and within a day, I got called by the campus radio to be interviewed about that. And she was really excited. Yeah, she was like, this is so cool. And I said, that's the power of, you know, blogging out in the open. So, so far, I have not had any negative experiences. Crossing my fingers on that one, and I've told them how to make sure that the comments do not just automatically get posted, that they have to be moderated. But it is their own blog, so I'm not actually moderating the comments myself, right? So they could get some kind of nasty stuff, and I'm not seeing it and blocking it or anything. So that has not happened, but I suppose it could.
And that's sort of a comment I just want to come back to, too, that I really like about how you guys have set this up, is the students are actually blogging within their own space rather than within a university, within a sort of envelope space. So just as an example, instead of turning an assignment in through an LMS and not having really control of where that assignment in the LMS is, when they're blogging, they're within their own blog, and then you're basically syndicating those over an RSS feed. So ultimately, the students have control a lot over their own blog.
Yeah, and I do wonder about that a little bit, because with UBC blogs, I guess it would be pretty easy to export that to something else if they want to. I mean, I told them they have to use UBC blogs. It was just like I gave them a video cast on how to do it, and they all did it. But if they wanted to have even more control and not have it be part of UBC, I suppose they could export it.
Yeah, absolutely. UBC Blogs is just a very standard WordPress install, so they can just easily export it and import it anywhere. That's one of the nice things about that. Nice to choose from the blog. It's very easily supported.
Good.
So I'd be interested in feedback from you guys. You know, those who have seen the site, or, you know, Will and so on, have been involved in the project for a long time. We're open to, you know, ideas, criticisms, suggestions.
I have one question for Christina and John. something I've kind of noticed with more and more kind of experimental ed technology projects or different platforms is I've really kind of come to understand that if the instructor isn't prepared to really use a different tool themselves and really engage with it. So if they're going to have their students blogging, the instructor needs to be blogging. If they're going to send their students to Wikipedia, they really should spend some time in Wikipedia themselves. And you can't just kind of, you know, throw a technology at the students and hope that the instructional technology unit can pick up the slack for support. And that sounds really obvious, but it's surprisingly common. So I know that Christine and John, you both use all the tools that are kind of attached to Arts One, you know, and you're both very committed to using the tools that you're working with yourself and really getting to know them well. But you're working with a lot of other instructors. I'm wondering if there are instructors who, you know, just aren't interested in open tools and platforms, and if you've noted any kind of rough spots in terms of the experience coming out of that.
Other instructors not interested in doing this stuff?
Yeah, or just maybe they don't, you know, they're like, well, I'm not here to blog, I'm here to do this, you know, this way of teaching, and you know, you guys can do it if you want. I'm just curious, you know, I'm guessing that the other instructors aren't as engaged with these technologies as you two are. Have you noted any kind of disjunctions out of that?
I actually, you know, it's funny, I haven't talked to that many people about all this stuff since I got back from Australia in July. And the people that I have talked to have all been ones who are interested in doing it. You know, so whenever I'm asked to give a presentation or something about open education, it's always people who are interested in open education. And then others, I haven't really been proselytizing in any deep sense. But I mean, in Arts One, not everybody is doing this with their students, and it is a choice for them to do it or not. And the other group is, so far as I know, nobody is doing it with the other group. It's just the group that John and I are in.
I mean, I'd say on the one hand, it's kind of been important to me, at least, that we're not pushing this on anybody. So it is all entirely optional. There may come a point at which, this is especially because I'm one of those ill people, you know, like I'm going to be in Arts One for a couple of years, and there's other people like Christina who are going to have to live with any, if there were any broader changes, they're going to have to live with them for longer. There may come a point, I think, at which Christina and the other people who are there full time might want to think about more general changes, but I'd leave that up to them. But I'd say that all the feedback that we've got is positive. I'd say that I'd say also it's not just us two. I mean, for instance, at least one of our other colleagues who comes from English, very keen on this kind of stuff. There's been a certain amount of reticence, which is related to people's reticence with the whole MOOC discourse. But I gave it was kind of interesting because as a result of what I was doing last year, I was invited to give a talk to the English department with somebody who was teaching on Arts One last year. And we gave a talk about MOOCs, which a whole bunch of people were there who were also involved with Arts One. And we were able to sort of talk about what we were doing within the more sort of general panorama of, you know, the university's top-down push towards what they're calling flexible learning, the Coursera, the sort of, you know, the national, international panorama of, you know, privatization and corporatization of education. And I had a really good discussion going, including with some people in Arts One who are not adopting this technology. And I thought that was really useful. And it might be useful to have sort of to create other spaces, I think, maybe sort of sponsored by Arts One, in which we can talk about that broader panorama and why we're choosing the kinds of choices that are still available, right? The fact that one can try and do some of these things, but in ways that you yourself have more control over, in which you don't sell your soul to Coursera. Will Long did, so he doesn't care about that. In which you can in which you emphasize openness and you emphasize experimentation, and it's not simply about whatever cost cutting and so on and so forth. So it'd be interesting if we had more of those spaces within S1 amongst the instructors or sort of sponsored by S1 talking to other members of the campus community.
Yeah, I would say I like to think of this as an alternative way of being open at the university to the direction that the open online courses are continuing to go. So that's why we really want to push it and keep it going so that people can see, look, you could do this instead. So I agree with John on that 100%. In terms of people being reticent, I think part of the issue is workload. It doesn't necessarily take that much longer, one might think, to write some blog posts and comment on students' blog posts, but I have found that it actually takes longer than I would have thought. You know, to monitor that they are blogging, to comment on their blog posts, and then I only manage to get one up every 2 or 3 weeks myself. I'm certainly not doing it every week like I had originally hoped I would. So part of it is just the idea of, well, that's all fine and good. That's a great idea, but how do you explain, or how do you help me deal with my workload? Right, that's what I can imagine some people saying to this. Oh, I see John's got something in the chat. Very sad to see that at least one of the flexible learning projects that are ongoing, the instructor was prevented from making blogs open.
Yes.
Without giving too much away, so this was an instructor who wanted to be open and wasn't allowed?
Yeah, this is a colleague of mine in history. It was one of the projects that was showcased in a recent town hall run by the dean, in which I asked a question about openness, because openness wasn't mentioned once in this, whatever it was, hour and a half, 2 hour session about flexible learning. And I noticed that this instructor's blogs, course blogs, were all behind the CWL paywall. And this happens to be a friend of mine. So I said to her, why was it behind the CWL paywall? And she said I was told that I had to do that.
Very strange. Because it seems to me that students can choose whether they want it to be public or not.
And it also seems that instructors should be able to sort of set the instructional model as well.
Yeah. I mean, she didn't. I guess she didn't know exactly about the possibilities. I mean, I said she was told that she had to do this because of, I don't know, copyright concerns or something like that, and I was like, you know, so copyright is being used used again as a sort of bat to beat professors with.
That is a common thing. I'm encountering more and more people. I sat in on an information security workshop at this university, and it was fine for the most part. But it was stated a couple of times with great authority that you just couldn't have students interact with an American-hosted site. And if you did, you were subjecting the university to massive fines and the tens of millions of dollars. So, for example, the kind of stuff like, you know, authoring on a Wikipedia site would fall under that. And it was just kind of stated as fact. I really should know these things.
Yeah.
Well, and I also think that there's a opportunity for open to really have an instructor or a university take control of their copyright footprint, for lack of a better word. So I've seen a number of different projects where they had questionable copyright materials being used in the courses, but it was fine because it was behind a university paywall, and only really the students could do it. But when they shifted their course to an open course, it really prompted them to go back through the materials they were using and find open materials, or find, in one case, the materials were already open, but just to make it a more accessible version. So one instructor I know went through and found, he had a list of something like 100 readings, and he found open versions of every single one of those readings, a lot of preprints, a lot of public domain materials coming from places like archive.org or the Gutenberg Project. So it was a really valuable property, because, or valuable maneuver for him to take control sort of the copyright of his copyright footprint in that course. And I see that as a benefit for instructors and universities engaging in open.
It's counterintuitive at best to think that having people behind firewalls is going to promote copyright compliance. I mean, you know, the dirty secret, the reason why a lot of instructors love their LMS is it allows them to put, you know, dodgy stuff up there with the sense that they're protected.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I didn't go quite as far as the person that you were talking about, Will, but I did put most of my readings up online on an open page this year for the first time. And I did try really hard to find as many open versions as I could. I didn't go so far as to look at preprints, which would have been a really great idea, but I'm going to do that next time. No, I just think I thought I was talking to somebody about how wouldn't it be nice if the library could help us with that? You know, helping us to find open materials that we could use in our courses and place on the website.
It encourages good practice. So, for instance, because the lectures are all on put onto YouTube, you know, it's forcing me to use as far as possible open images or openly accessible images. I sort of, you know, skirt at the edges of that occasionally where necessary, but it's not that difficult. And then, as I just put up on the chat, in terms of the text that we're making available, there are a couple of PDFs which we don't want to make openly available, and I just constructed a password protected page on WordPress for those, and then the students know given the password for that. So, yeah, I mean, it's simple enough. You know, there are many other options other than putting everything behind the CWO firewall.
So, John, you want to talk a little bit about the podcast too? Because I wasn't involved in that last year at all.
Well, the podcast, so last year, it's okay, the students, they go through the year and they do the techs. And well, last year was in more or less chronological order, but then when it comes to the final exam, they're asked to come up with new combinations, right, to make the text talk to each other in different ways than they've been asked over the year. So a couple of fellow instructors and I thought, well, why don't we sort of help them with this by taking 10 minutes or so, sitting down in an office and talking about two texts that we hadn't put together in over the course of the year. So, for instance, he taught Beowulf in the first semester, and I taught, I can't remember, Borges in the second semester. And so we sat down. He had a more or less fancy microphone, and we shared an office, actually, our joint office. We chatted for about 5 minutes about what the kinds of topics we wanted to cover, then turned on the microphone and chatted for another 10 minutes, this time recorded and turned off the microphone, and we had a very sort of basic but I think quite useful, the students that I talked to found it useful, kind of a model of for the students about the ways in which to think about bring together two texts in the preparation for the final exam. And so we put a bunch of, about three of us did this last year. We put, I don't know what, four, five, six or so of them online. And it was pretty quick and pretty simple, which again are kind of the watchwords of what we're trying to do. And so one of my fellow instructors said to me just the other week, when are we going to do some more podcasts? Because it's also kind of fun, actually. So I hope that we get back to doing that. And I also, as I've been saying, want to kind of experiment with some video podcasts. In fact, I hope to do one maybe today or tomorrow in a kind of a preparation. This would be a kind of just preparation for the lecture that I'm giving on Monday. Just a little 10-minute thing, turn on the video, talk to it for 10 minutes about some of the things in the book while they're still reading it. Stick it up, and then it becomes a sort of shorter, more sort of modular preparation for the class ahead, and maybe something that's also useful elsewhere, because it's not, you know, it doesn't require the patience and discipline of sitting down and watching a two-hour lecture. I'm really into such experimentation, and again, if we had time, resources, I'd be interested in you know, paying people to edit such podcasts. But at the moment, you know, I think we can do something just by doing the simple editing of turning the camera on and turning it off and going from there.
Thanks.
Well, great. I think I kind of want to just end the discussion with what you guys have been talking about, but what sort of advice would you recommend to both educational technologists who are supporting faculty on projects like this, but also other faculty members who would want to be interested in doing something like this at their home institution?
Christina, do you want to start?
Let's see. Well, the thing that helped me to be able to do all this is just having a good amount of support from the IT people at the university. We've got some great people who work on WordPress and who you know, you can meet with every week in a drop-in session, and that really helped me. This was for my other course, but I was opening that up a bit more. But then, yeah, I mean, part of it is just learning how to use WordPress and how to start up a blog yourself. And it is a bit of a learning curve in getting all that going, and especially if you wanted to do something like podcasts, that's another learning curve and things like that. So just in terms of what an individual has to do, there does have to be a fair bit of time put into learning how to use the materials first or the tools first. I don't really know what other advice I can give other than make sure you have the time to do that. But I don't know. I suppose the other thing is that just to know that these possibilities are out there and you don't have to just use the LMS. Like, you know, a few years ago, I just used the LMS because that's what everybody did. And that's the only thing that anybody told me about. So I really didn't dig any further. And yeah. So the more we make these kinds of projects available and known about, the more faculty members might actually see that there are other options than only doing everything through the LMS and having that be behind a wall that most people can't see.
Yeah, I'd say just, you know, there are lots of possibilities out there, and there are people in places like CTLT and ISIT and UBC who are willing and more than willing, just dying to help out with this kind of stuff, you know? They're being corralled into stuff like the Connect and Coursera and so on, and they're keen to do other things. So we're getting immense support. I mean, we're getting no money, no resources, but we're getting people doing this kind of thing off the side of their desk. You know, the Arts IST, for instance. I mean, originally, when I wanted to get these videos taped, these lectures taped, we were being quoted a price of, I think it was $500 an hour.
Yeah.
To take them from the official, what they call it, lecture capture service. So like with one lecture, we would have bust the budget of Arts One for the year, essentially. Yeah. So then we looked at various other possibilities, including getting students to tape them with my camera or something. And Arts IST sort of stepped in and said, you know, we're interested in helping out with this, and we won't charge you, and because we think this is a great project. So, you know, there are other resources out there. You have to probably say no to the first, like, two or three people who come to you and want to charge you an arm and a leg. But if you keep looking, if you keep asking, then things can happen and be done. I'd say the other thing is that it's really good to have good colleagues. I mean, it's great working with Christina and previously with other people. There's a guy called Kevin, Jill, who's still there, who were also keen on this and making it kind of fun. And it's good also that kind of, I don't know, it balances out certain, I mean, Christina's much more sort of orderly and disciplined than I am. And I think that makes for a good combination of my more kind of wacky, just let's go and do this and who cares about the consequences. So, you know, like working with other people like that, and that's also part of the fun of working at Arts One. It is this team taught interdisciplinary course, and it goes well with the kinds of things that we're trying to do here with Arts One Open.
And you kind of hit on something that I really like too, is this has really been an iterative project. It hasn't been, you know, you sort of, you went and tried different experiments for videotaping, you you're out there constantly sort of improving upon it. And it wasn't seen as, here's the final, you know, here's what Arts One Open is, and here's what we're going to reach that goal. Instead, you've been sort of improving it as you go along.
Yep.
So just to come back, and maybe I'll ask Ryan, a couple weeks ago was the big open education conference, and it was held this year in Park City, Utah. And I'm gonna try to make a quick link between what we've been talking about and what that, but one of the presentations I was really struck by David Cunningham afterwards, and there's a lot of talk of gloom and doom in open ed about what is going on with the sort of corporate MOOC model. And that, and someone had asked, well, how do we as people who are supporting open education make a difference? And he basically said, I have a three-word answer, and that is start a blog, which I thought was a great answer. And what I think sort of neat about the projects you're doing is you're creating a competency and a literacy in your learners for having that ability to start a blog and get their voices out there.
Yeah. And I hope, somebody asked earlier, I think maybe it was Cindy, are they using them post, you know, Arts One? Are they continuing to use them? And that's my hope. This isn't the first time I've done it with students, so we're still in the first year for mine. But one of the things I put into a recent grant proposal was that we would like to track if students are continuing to use them long after they've left Arts One, maybe just through a survey or something. And I'm hoping that they can create a kind of learning portfolio of some kind where they're actually talking about their other courses and, you know, what they're doing at UBC in their blogs, as well as having sections of it that could be just for their own personal reflections on life, which is fine too. So that's the nice thing about the RSS feed is that you can just take in one category and bring it into your course, but they can talk about lots of other things on their blogs if they wish.
And, of course, yeah. That's the vast improvement of using blogs than using Connect or Blackboard or whatever it is. It's the, with Connect or Blackboard, we take their work away from them at the end of the semester. They don't have access back to it. You know, their blog is theirs after the course is over. And they can, well, they can delete it if they want, but they can also keep it as a kind of record of the kind of things that they've been doing in their career and at university and start to sort of, you know, I don't know, model their or shape their online identity as learners and students and thinkers to some extent.
Okay.
Well, and before we wrap up, I just wanted to see if there was any other questions, or Brian, if you had any other thoughts.
No, I fired my questions in.
Well, I really want to thank both John and Christina for being here today and for, I think, what was a great discussion and exactly what we're hoping these BC Open Ed, what we're calling BC Open Ed Chats to be. And I just want to note that we do have another one scheduled on December 13th. We don't have any topics. We really hope that people out there who are working on projects, if you want to line something up, you know, this is completely open and we're not trying to set an agenda or a schedule. We're hoping that this sort of is a grassroots, grounds-up approach to these talks. I also want to know, we're going to be moving the website to a permanent website, and we just got a URL for that permanent website. Nothing's there yet. And we're totally open for better URLs if people can come up to it, but keep your eye on bcopened.org, which is pretty straightforward. But if anybody has any better suggestions, we can go that way too.
Sounds great. I always
know
where to find the wiki.
Yeah, and it's easier there as well. And we'll have the audio recordings up from the last two as well.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot. Have a good day. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Yes, thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. And thanks again to Frank for hosting this for us as well.
I think I had to leave.
You are currently the only person in this conference.